Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. And now we continue with incarnation. India, 1998. Krishna Anand attended university in Mumbai and became president of the academic fraternity in which his father had been a brother. His business studies prepared him well for running the chain of inns his father had built for business travelers working in the burgeoning information technology companies of Karnataka and the major government and business centers of Mumbai and New Delhi. Krishna excelled in running the company, and his father soon went into semi-retirement. Mr. Anand spent his retired time cultivating his spiritual side, as is the tradition among the devout, and Krishna accompanied him to all the important Hindu holiday rituals. He spent his business time visiting the various properties in the hotel catalog that he and his son were growing into Anand Holdings. Krishna took advantage of his father's absences to update the firm's business practices. He also used the time to visit Kamalita, who was in medical school at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in Delhi. The forced separation of their teen years had only fueled their early relationship, and Krishna made the polite gesture of keeping the disobedience from his father's view, though Mr. Anand knew well that his son frequently visited the girl that he spoke of to his friends as Dr. Harlot. Krishna's mother took ill the year Dr. Harlot became a fellow in the oncology department of Bangalore Medical College. While her cancer was confined to her lungs, it had advanced to a degree that made her likelihood of survival slim without surgery. The surgery itself was expected to give her only another 2 to 5 years, but if she was to have any quality of life, the surgery was indicated. Mrs. Anand spent a week before surgery in the hospital for tests and monitoring. Krishna needed to be away on business, leaving his father on his own to deal with his wife's and his own anxieties. Mr. Anand hated hospitals in general, and the impending procedure terrified him. Kamalita had been by repeatedly to check in on Mrs. Anand. Mr. Anand greeted her with indifference whenever he saw her. "Why are you so mean to Kamalita?" his wife wheezed at his newspaper. He plopped the paper into his lap, and his face turned red. "If you think I am going to let that harlot steal my son's fortune, which I have built up over a lifetime, I tell you, I will never." He picked up the paper and emitted a grunt. His wife bobbled her head slightly and spoke as if addressing one of the newspaper's more understanding journalists instead of her husband. "She has no need of his money. These are modern days, my love. She is a doctor who will make lots of money herself, and she is very lovely to us all." Both the Anands were sleeping in the long light of the afternoon when Kamalita brought the hospital dietitian into the room. She gently pressed Mrs. Anand's shoulder to wake her. Mr. Anand woke, but quickly closed his eyes to avoid conversation while listening in. "Mrs. Anand," Kamalita began softly, "I told the dietitian that you are having difficulty with the menu choices and that she must prepare whatever you ask for." "Oh, that is not necessary, dear." "Yes, it is. You must be strong and as healthy as possible for your surgery. I spoke with your team and cleared this with them, so please, whatever you want, just let Ms. Deshpande know." "Thank you so much, dear. And would it be possible to get something for Mr. Anand? He has been here all day, only drinking chai and eating cakes." Mrs. Deshpande sighed and whispered to Kamalita. The doctor nodded and turned back to Mrs. Anand. "She can get in trouble for that, but I am on a break. Tell me what he likes and I'll go out and get it." Mrs. Anand had begun telling her to get him something simple and healthy when Mr. Anand pretended to wake up. After listening to them explain what he had already heard, he placed his own order with Kamalita over his wife's objections and familiar warning that he should eat better. Having jotted down the order with one wink to Mr. Anand and another at his wife, Kamalita's beeper buzzed at her hip, and she excused herself, waving off the money he held out to pay for the food. Though he would not admit it to his wife, over the course of the week, Mr. Anand was put more and more at ease by Kamalita's attentiveness. She described some details of the surgery. She showed him diagrams in a medical book. She explained the recovery therapies. She introduced him to the medical team. She brought him chai. The morning before the scheduled surgery, Kamalita noticed Mr. Anand perspiring and rubbing his chest. She called for a wheelchair and escorted him to the cardiology department. That evening, His health was greatly improved by the new arterial stent allowing blood to flow unimpeded to his heart muscle, but the procedure had left him exhausted physically and emotionally. Krishna, who had returned a day early from his trip when his father became ill, went back and forth between the surgical waiting room and the room Mr. Anand occupied one floor below. His father slept narcotically through his wife's surgery, and when he awoke, Krishna told him his mother had done fine and was already back in her room right above him. Through his druggy days, he asked Kamalita which spouse would be up visiting the other first. She guessed that he would. As he fell back asleep, he said, "I love you, dear." Kamalita and Krishna looked at each other with eyes wide and giggled as the oblivious Mr. Anand began snoring. Krishna Anand lost his mother in the winter of the next year. As somewhat of a consolation for the loss of one parent, he felt a positive change in the other. Mr. Anand became a softer version of himself. He smiled more. He became more interested in the new practices Krishna established at work instead of constantly restating how things had been done before. But most importantly, he embraced Kamalita, even quite literally when he would see her at the house. Then he started inviting her and Krishna to join him for Sunday restaurant dinner, a weekly ritual Mr. and Mrs. Anand enjoyed for 20 years. Mr. Anand and Krishna were reviewing proofs of a new advertising campaign for tech magazines. Krishna was braced for resistance to the look of the models in the ads, who dressed and shaved like actual software engineers rather than the suit and tie businessmen that were a mainstay of their ads. "I am very convinced," Mr. Anand began, and Krishna started ticking off in his head the prepared defenses he had ready. "Now that Kamalita has graduated and your dear mother left us more than a year ago, will she not think you insincere if you do not marry her? To say nothing of her mother, who wanted you married years ago and is probably sending her HinduMate.com pictures of eligible venture capitalists in Bangalore." Krishna was startled, then smiled at this reprimand. He reached into his briefcase and pulled out a small box. He opened the box to his father's expanding eyes, previewing the scene he hoped to play out with Kamalita at Sunday dinner. His father clutched his boy's hand and shook them before beginning to laugh, then cry. "Father, why are you crying?" "Your mother should be coming to this wedding. It would be the joy of her life." "Father, you were the joy of her life, as she was yours." Mr. Anand began crying even harder. "I'm so ashamed. She is gone only a year, and I am already unfaithful to her."
"Unfaithful how, father?"
he muttered to himself, then blubbered.
"I've been looking at the Hindu mate web myself. You are telling me of your wedding, and I started thinking of getting a date for the occasion."
Krishna tried unsuccessfully to purse away the smile that erupted on his face. "Father, mother is gone. You cannot be unfaithful to her. You can continue the joy that she brought us by going on with life. Her karma was to leave. Yours is to carry on."
"You live up to your namesake with such wisdom, my son.
But still, I will come to the wedding as a widower, with your mother's memory as my companion." Kamalita's entire house in Tumkur was draped in a garland of flowers. The wedding guests were to arrive in 4 hours. Krishna and Mr. Anand came via limousine from the train station. A houseman met the Anands at the front door, took their bags, and pointed them across the foyer toward the dining room for a lunch for the close family of the bride and groom. Mr. Anand saw Kamalita through the doorway at the far end of the long, elaborately set table. In this sun-drenched, traditional setting, she was even more beautiful than usual. He and Krishna made their way into the immense dining room. He could not take his eyes from the strangely radiant and transformed bride-to-be. Krishna startled him by softly cooing, "Kamalita ji," as though she could hear him across the room. Mr. Anand was further surprised to hear Kamalita's voice answer, "Welcome, my love." He turned to see his son and Kamalita embracing. He welcomed her hug as she broke from the sun to greet the father.
"Come, say hello to my mother," Kamalita said, dragging both of them by the hand toward the object of Mr. Anand's confusion.
He pulled his glasses from his jacket pocket and followed. A few relatives speaking to Angarika stepped to the side as Kamalita brought her groom and his father near.
"Welcome to our home, Mr. Anand, on this joyous occasion. I am only sorry your wife cannot share in this happiness with us. I lost my husband nearly 10 years ago. My sympathies are with you."
Mr. Anon nearly stared at her smooth burgundy lips as she spoke to him. Then he replied, "Our karma has dictated that we cherish the time we had with our spouses, and now it is our task to carry on. I too wish my wife could have seen our son marry." He noticed the curve of Angarika's body under the silk sari and felt a rush as though he had just drunk some gin. "I hope I will not presume too much to ask if we may accompany each other through these joyful events." He smiled a bit uncomfortably at the boldness of his tone in response to her condolences. Angarika tilted her head down slightly and looked up at him with deep brown eyes. "I will be honored to be your partner for the celebration." Mr. Anon felt a desire that made him divert his eyes to the floor like a guilty schoolboy. India, 2037. Krishna Anand, at the pinnacle of his career at age 65, was walking along the Ganges. His Seville rose suit contrasted with the nearly naked bodies of sadhus sitting on the steps descending into the holy river. He turned left into the morning sun and headed toward the hotel that he had erected on this spot. Marketed to the tens of thousands of international yoga enthusiasts as an Indian yoga holiday in the best of Western accommodations, the Rishikesh Hotel was the fruition of 5 years of work and the crown jewel in Anand's real estate empire. Krishna had made this daily pilgrimage from the apartment he kept at the town center to his suite on the penthouse level of the hotel since the week the elevator was installed, through final interior construction and punch list repairs, and 6 months of serving the public. Today was unique, though. He was about to turn over his primary activities to his appointed successor. He was about to retire. The thought of retiring had haunted him as much as it had thrilled him. Since his wife Kamalita had passed last year, he longed to do something he could never have done when she was with him, make an extended pilgrimage in the Himalayas. The irony was not lost on him, the owner of a 4-star ashram right here on the Ganges. Yet there was a pull, like hunger, forcing him on every time a business acquaintance or his own logic raised a doubt. A large splash in the water behind him startled him and broke his stride. He turned a step toward the river to see the cause. An immense man, naked except for a loincloth, climbed out of the water and stared right at Krishna Anand with a smile that was radiant, despite there being only a few teeth in it. The sadhu's dreadlocked hair and painted skin marked him as a tantrika, a practitioner of a yoga that claimed to bring understanding of and even control over the workings of the world. The tantrika waved Krishna toward him and persisted as the businessman looked left and right to see if the call was directed to another. Wary though he was of a member of a sect often rumored to be secretive, wild, and even violent, Krishna walked toward the dripping figure with a puffed-up posture meant to show that he was not someone to be taken advantage of. "I do not desire money from you, Lord Krishna," the man said with a loud chuckle. "Forgive me," Krishna said, assuming the statement meant its opposite, and fished in his pocket for some coins to make a customary donation of alms to the holy man. The tantrika recited a blessing from the Bhagavad Gita. "The offering is Brahman. That offered is Brahman. It is offered by Brahman in the fire that is Brahman. Thus spoke Lord Krishna." Krishna was accustomed to hearing prayers to the deity in Hindu pantheon for whom he was named. But the next time the tantrika used his name, it startled him. "Krishna Anand, may I humbly offer my assistance, for I too am Krishnananda." The tantrika giggled. That this sadhu knew his name and his unusual offer in response to alms made Krishna uncomfortable. He bowed to the tantrika with palms pressed together, then began to leave. "You go to America," the tantrika shouted. Krishna spun back around. "America? I am too old for that. Anyway, I don't know why I should tell you, but I'm going into the Himalayas because I desire to focus on the spirit. You should like that." The sadhu laughed and slapped his legs with both hands. "Spirit is everywhere, Krishna Anand. Until you realize that, you try to fulfill desires in this life, then another, forever spinning on samsara's wheel of incarnations." "That is all very interesting, but I will look into it more during my pilgrimage. But I must go to a meeting, with some Americans, in fact." The tantrika spun around and jumped like a cannonball into the river, soaking the steps and splashing Krishna's 60,000 rupee loafers. When he surfaced, he shouted, "No Himalayas, America! Hare Krishna!" And with the prayer to Lord Krishna, he pushed out into the current, floating on his back, and became as still as a dead man. Krishna Anand noticed the hands of the buoyant yogi, each with index finger and thumb touching to form a circle afloat on the water. The two circles gave Krishna pause. He saw they were like two worlds, the one he was leaving and the one he was about to enter. Well, of all the possible ways to start a day, that was the oddest, Krishna said, and turned back toward his hotel and his plan to go to the holy mountains. The leather sole of his right shoe, smoothed to a gloss by the hands of an Italian craftsman, was about to meet an embankment stone, smoothed to a hollow by the feet of millennia of pilgrims. A thin puddle of splashed Ganges prevented the consummation of the meeting. His soul slipped. The result was emphatic. Krishna Anand would not go to the Himalayas in this lifetime. The following Tuesday, Anand Holdings employees were given the option to take the day off to attend the funeral of the company director. India, another 1992. See these harlots again, and I will cut you off completely. When Krishna went to college in Mumbai, the memory of his father's treatment of him and Kamalita stung like a pinprick to his pride. They continued to fester emotionally until the perpetrator became the effigy of all the injustices a college boy sees as learning opens up his eyes. Mr. Anand, the father, became the surrogate for the university administration, for the egomaniacs who turned Marxist philosophy into a totalitarian nightmare, for the injustices of the girls who refused his advances, for the remnants of the caste system, for the corporate greed that sustained poverty while creating a business-based aristocracy, and ultimately for India, a home hopelessly frozen in the rigidity of the past. He studied computer science and became fascinated with the internet as a means of providing power to influence people and change the world. The avalanche of assigned emotions that crashed through the father-son relationship during those 4 years carved such a deep rift that he never visited his home in Bangalore again, never contacted Kamalita, applied for graduate studies in America, and left without saying goodbye. Krishna sat in his rented room in Troy, New York, a half mile from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, where he studied programming. He was on the phone while he gazed at the photograph of himself with his mother pinned to his bulletin board. He reflexively smoothed his hair when he noticed it sticking up in the photograph, though now it was pulled flat in a long ponytail. "I am not a hotelier, mother. How many times must I say this? My life is here. My work is here. I am not hearing any apology from him, am I?" "My dear boy, he loves you, but he is too proud to ask himself for your forgiveness. And your help." She hoped calling might sway him. He had ignored her written pleas to forgive his father and return to help with the business. "I have made my choice and cannot go back. I invite you to come whenever you like. My door is open to you." His mother countered that his father would not come and she could not come without him. "I will not come with my tail between my legs back to my father's arrogance. I have created myself for myself. I am not just his future replacement who must do what he wills." Mrs. Anand knew from her husband the depth of Anand's stubbornness, and she recognized it in her son. She continued to correspond with him, but never again broached the topic of his return. Krishna learned in a voicemail message from her during his fourth year at RPI that his father had died of a heart attack. But the funeral was the week he was sitting for a PhD review, and he could not face interrupting everything he had prepared for so intensively to return home. In a moment of frustration with his mother, he yelled, "He is fighting even by death to get me to stop my chosen work and come back to India." Krishna's mother became ill a month later. He went home and spent a week at her bedside before she succumbed to lung cancer. He cried almost without pause for 2 days, but on the third, he woke up, went to a barber who cut off his long hair, dressed in an American jacket and necktie even though it was 80 degrees, and went to the funeral of both his mother and his motherland. The day after the services, he hired an attorney to handle the disposition of his family's estate, which would provide him with enough money to finish his studies and leave India forever behind. The only memento he took was the gold and ebony cane that his father always forbade him to touch, though it never left the umbrella vase at the front door. New York, 2000. The relationship started from a surrender, the surrender that comes easily in a dream, when one finds an object of attraction suddenly in hand, ripe for the taking. Like when a dreamer finds that the place in the bed just occupied by her husband, without transition, holds the object of a crush turning to kiss her. Krishna Anand was speaking with Ryoko Kimura in an Albany Network TV newsroom. He was hot and felt a drop of sweat run from his armpit toward his waist. He was glad he had chosen the dark brown tweed sport coat, which would hide any perspiration even if his shirt became soaked, but he knew it was also contributing to that perspiration. What would it cost for the typical consumer to use your product, Mr. Anand? Are you talking about a new device in the average home? Ryoko asked. Krishna wondered why the studio lights seemed to have no effect on the reporter, whose lovely silk blouse seemed fresh and crisp. He answered the question, "My product, as you call it, is really just an application, and as such it can be ported to any device that you want to compile it for. So it's not so much as something you buy that will spawn sales as it is, one might hope, a killer app that everyone would incorporate into the technological dialogue, if it catches on, of course. But you are talking about interacting with everyone in a medium that is typically one way, that is, broadcaster to the public. True, but if you think about simple comment sections, which grace virtually every web page in existence, you have the general idea. My innovation creates a platform that makes that sharing manageable for television shows. Ryoko's interview was the first press Krishna had received for his software. The TV spot managed to pique some editorial interest, and in response to requests for a more in-depth piece for Ryoko's network, she was now crowded next to him in his tiny lab at RPI. The equipment consisted of several server computers, a chaotic junction box that looked like a petrified Tesla coil, where a coil's unbound electrical paths had been turned into static gray-sheathed wires, a laptop, and two television monitors. "Can you show me the software in action?" Ryoko asked after his mind-numbing explanation of the various hardware components had left her at a loss. "Oh yes," he replied, and began turning on the various components of the system. "And will we be looking at a demo program?" she asked, trying to make sense of what he had already explained but that went over her head. "No, no, TV programming is live. The software is absolutely set for interactivity with the existing publishing mechanisms." "Okay," she started hedging, trying not to sound like an idiot, modulating her voice so the sentence could be read as either a statement or a question. "So we'll be interacting with actual TV." Krishna liked the sound of her voice and was happy to keep further simplifying his explanations. "This will be a kind of a mock-up because we can't go on air without permission, but short of sending the signal into the broadcast stream, it is exactly accurate. I bring TV in through this cable. My software serves as the interface between a web-based comment client and the broadcast image." A reality TV show appeared on the left-hand monitor, and then on the right. In it, an abnormally buxom woman named Rianne was arguing with the daughter about the appropriate way the mother should dress when the daughter's friends come over. Krishna typed some text into a form on his laptop and hit the button at the bottom marked comment. His comment, "This lady's breasts are too big," began scrolling over a black sidebar on the right-hand edge of the image, like movie credits, but moving slowly, making it easy to read. If you imagine for a moment that we are the broadcast studio, that instead of taking this cable from a provider, running it through my box, and sending it to this monitor, we could take the show pre-distribution and run it through my system simultaneously as we released it to the distribution networks. Okay, so let me see if I get this now that I'm seeing it. I'm watching a show, this show. I want to make a comment, so I type it in where? Currently, I've implemented the system using a web-based widget. Say a website. So a station might use this method to list its shows on its website, and a link would take you to the comment page for that show. You comment. Your comment shows up in the scrolling feed. "Got it," she said, relieved. "But there's a delay, right? I mean, you see something and then you want to comment on it, but by the time it's commented on, that scene has passed." "Well, that's true, but given the way people watch TV, I don't see that as much of an issue. Most people I see talk over TV anyway, so they're already commenting after the fact, just verbally. A voice-to-digital button on the comment page will allow you to use your computer mic, and that comment that was formerly spoken into your living room will now go live. And I imagine most comments are going to be overarching rather than specific. I'll buy that. So number two, what about the sheer volume of comments? If everyone switches what they're saying into a comment, won't it overwhelm the viewing experience? I'd be lying if I said I knew. But if you look at websites as the only existing example, you see that many don't get comments at all. A few get a lot, but almost none get the same thing over and over again. I expect that people will only make the effort to comment if they are really moved by something, and even then, only if they feel that no one else has made that comment. And I guess it's no big deal because, as I think you said, the whole comment view would be optional. True enough. But more importantly, if it gets overwhelming, the software provides an AI editor sort, summarizing comments by keyword or other parameters. She nodded, artificial intelligence editor. So you can specify that you only want comments about breasts, for instance. He laughed. Well, you could do it yourself, but the software includes facial recognition algorithms and matches up names in the dialogue or metadata with the faces on the screen, so it will suggest the default summaries. But you could override all that and even limit it only to comments about the daughter's breasts. You know, I guess I was thinking about this whole project in terms of passionate opinions or fact-checking, but when I saw what you just typed, no offense meant, I saw how inane the comments could become. Ryoko, how could any comment be more inane than that programming itself? An hour later, Ryoko slid into bed next to Joey Koh, who was dreaming of a scene he had recently played in a sitcom. She had been testing Krishna Anand's system for 3 hours before noticing the time. The evening had blurred by, Ryoko digitally bantering with Krishna over a dozen TV shows, watching, remarking, reading comments, counter-commenting, fighting over the remote, flipping to a new show, laughing, ordering sushi, drinking shots of Glenlivet from the bottle rather than the coffee mugs he had available, debating barware aesthetics in a scroll over a network newscap about weather, thrilling to the improvisational possibilities of writing on the fly with someone smiling at everything she expressed into the voice to digital, extending her hand, accepting his hug in return with a giggle, and driving the 45 minutes to her Albany hotel suite, hoping her husband would be asleep and unaware of how late it was. Ryoko quickly fell into her own dream. In it, she was awake, and Joey had turned to her. She wasn't surprised that they were naked under the covers. He stroked her hair. She was unfazed that, inexplicably, Krishna Anand was facing her under the covers, in a bed she had never slept in a room she had never seen. She drew her hand down his arm and let it transfer to his hip. Krishna's lips grazed hers, and she felt the electricity of a first kiss. Then she wrapped her arms around him and pulled herself close. As she felt them merge, heat pouring through her, she woke to hot late morning sun pouring through the bedroom window. Joey was singing in the kitchen. That's it for today's excerpt. You can hear more later on in Peter's podcast. Or if you just can't wait, head over to Amazon.com where you can find Incarnation. Thanks.